very much integrated into the local culture, so much so that they marry one of the local people in that culture. It's a story about a good deed that was done for somebody very important that was forgotten for a long time, and then remembered at a critical moment. And when that deed was remembered, there was a turnaround in the story, and the turnaround actually turned out to be very, very good for the Jewish people. It's a story that the focus of the story takes place outside of the land of Israel, and the story concludes with the Jewish people being firmly entrenched outside of the land of Israel. It's a story about a king who has trouble sleeping, and the difficulty he has sleeping serves as a critical turning point in the entire narrative. It's a story about a king who has two advisors who are accused of being treasonous, and ends with a hanging. It's a story about somebody hatching a plan that is impossibly complex. It can't possibly work, and it does. It's a story with their accusations of sexual impropriety with the wife of a very important person. It's a story about a Jew who hides their identity for a very long time and only reveals that identity at a critical moment. Anybody know what story I'm talking about?
Yosef.
You think I'm talking about the other?
Yes.
But also Esther.
Yosef or Esther.
The two stories bear extraordinary resemblances to each other. Right? So much so that one would be led to believe that whoever's writing Megillat Esther is writing it to evoke the story of Yosef. There are a lot of different ways of writing a story. And the way we choose to record the events tells us a tremendous amount. You have a sheet in front of you that looks something like this, but without my scribbles on it. Okay? And if you take a look over here on the sheet, you'll see that that not only are the two stories being told in parallel kinds of ways, even the language of the two stories mirrors each other. Okay. And at the top, you'll see the story of Yosef and the story of Esther being mirrored. For example, when Ahasuerus is lonely because Vashti is gone, so his servants come to him and suggest that he have a beauty contest, the Riut. And that beauty contest involves setting up an entire bureaucracy of people who are going to be in charge of gathering all the beautiful women to bring them to the palace. V'afkeit ha-melech pikidim b'chol mitinot malchuto. You should set up these pikidim who are going to gather people. And that's that same exact language appears in the Yosef story. Because Yosef tells Paro, V'afkeit pikidim ala aretz, as part of the plan to gather all the wheat. So we have the gathering of the wheat of the Yosef story being mirrored by the gathering of the women in the story of Megillat Esther. And what should they be doing? It's not just V'yavkeir HaMelech Pekidim, that's number one on the page, but it continues in the continuation of that phrase, V'yikbitzu, and let them gather together, right? Et kol, V'yikbitzu, et kol, let them gather together either all the food from the good years or all the good women, good-looking women. Okay, that's handed to the king, and the response of the king is exactly the same. Number three, vayitav hadavar be'enei hamelech, or vayitav hadavar be'enei paro. Okay, the language is exactly the same language. Continue. We have the story of Megillat Esther. So you have. You have the great big beauty pageant, and the women The women, I think there's a little bit of a parody, but you know, the women in Persia were pickled. Shishach hodashim b'shemen hamor. 6 months, they're sitting there in oil. And another 6 months in perfume. Shishach hodashim b'shemen hamor v'shishach hodashim b'samim. It tells us something. I think there is something that's being said over here about the relationship of the Persian Empire to women and the kingdom. But it's the continuation of that pasuk that really strikes in over here. Ki kein yimlahu yemein mukehen, because that's what it took to complete spicing them for them to be ready to come to the king. The same exact language is used in the story of Yosef after Yaakov dies. He is embalmed for 70 days. Ki kein yimlahu yemei achanutim. The same language. So we have the embalming of Yaakov being mirrored by the embalming of the women, bringing them in some sort of perfected, plasticized state to Tachashverosh. Okay? In the story of Megillat Esther, Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. And the servants come to him and they say, "What are you doing?" And he says, "No." But he still refuses. Right? They came to him, they said to him day by day, and he refused to listen to them. And the same exact language is used in the story of Yosef as Mrs. Potiphar tries to seduce Yosef. She spoke to him on a daily basis. This is number 5 and number 6 on the sheets. The language is directly parallel. We continue on. Esther goes to as she accepts Mordechai's need to go to the king. She says, "V'chasher avadati avadati." Right? She refused for a while, and then finally she agrees. "V'chasher avadati avadati." In the story of Yosef, Yaakov refuses to send Binyamin together with his brothers. After Yehuda finally convinces him, he says, "V'chasher shacholti shacholti." Right? Same structure of the words, following the same kind of a theme. We continue on. Esther, talking to Achashverosh, says, "Ki echacha uchal v'ra'iti bara shayimtza tamei." She says, "How can I be silent, right, and see the evil that's going to befall my people?" And that's exactly what Yehuda says to Yosef as he's standing in front of him, number 8 and number 9. "Ki eche ele el avi, how will I go to my father, pen ere bara asher yimtza et avi?" Right? Even bara asher yimtza, and ami is replaced with avi. The same language, the same structure, and the same kind of thematic elements being woven through. And both of them, the king takes off his signet ring and hands it to the second in command, Vayasar HaMelech et Taba'ato, and Vayasar Paro et Taba'ato. He takes off his ring, and the person who he gives it to gets the title of Mishneh LaMelech. Let's take a look at another one. He gives it to Vayiteno Tal Yad Yosef, Vayitel Mordechai. When they each come into power, they each get a change of clothes. By Albeishet Mordechai, right? By Albeishoto, Bigdei Sheish. So Yosef gets Bigdei Sheish, Mordechai gets royal clothes, and they put him into a special chariot, right? Vayerkibehu Berchov Ha'ir. They put him into this chariot. That's in the case of where Haman is doing this to Mordechai. Vayikra lefanav kacha yaseh la'ish. And in the Yosef story, we have the same language. They put it by Albeisho to Bigdei Sheish, number 13, by Arkevo to Merkevet HaMishneh Asherlo. He goes into the chariot of the second in command, by Yikur'u Lefanav, just like by Yikra Lefanav. Okay? So we have, again, parallel language spanning a whole string of events. They're both called Mishneh LaMelech. These are the only two stories. Actually, there are three places in Tanakh where the term Yifei Toar v'Yifei Mar'eh appears.
Rachel.
Rachel is defined, is described as Yafat Torah v'Yafat Mar'eh. Yosef is described as Yifei Torah v'Yifei Mar'eh. And Esther is described as Yifat Torah v'Yifat Mar'eh. Those are the only three places you find in Tanakh in Yifat Torah, or you might find Yifat Mar'eh, but the combination of those two together appears basically in only these three places. Yosef, there's something about the Yosef story where everything Yosef does, right, he's successful. And everybody around him sees that. Mrs. Potiphar sees that. Potiphar sees that. His jailer sees that. Everything he does, he's successful. Yosef is the boy with the golden touch. Everybody likes him. And you have the same exact thing happening in the Esther story, in Gilat Esther. But he Esther no say thing, but in a koroya. Everybody who sees her likes her. There's something about her. They can't pin it down. But there's something about her. Right? Hey, guy sees Hamelech. He sees her. He sees hundreds of women. There's one that he says, I like you. Right? She didn't do anything. I like you. Let's take a look at the last three examples we have over here, and there are more. I sometimes, when I teach this to my students in the yeshiva, sometimes I'll give them a little task, and I'll tell them, find three things that are parallel between this, just three things. And I'll have them sit on their own or b'chavruta to find three parallels between the stories. And this chavruta finds five, and that one finds four, and that one finds seven, and that one finds... By the time we finish putting them together, we have 30 to 40 to 50 parallels. Because they're all finding different ones. And you put them together, and you get this picture that is so overwhelming that it is clear that whoever is sitting there writing the story of Megillat Esther had open in front of them the story of Yosef and said, okay, when I tell the story, this is how I want to tell the story. I want to tell the story as a mirror of what's happening with Yosef. And you see that in the last, you have tearing of clothes, you have the Beyom HaShlishi, and you have the word Vayit Apak, right? Or V'lo Yachol Lehit Apek, right? Yosef keeps holding himself back. Haman had to hold himself back. Right, the same kind of language. It's clear that when Megillat Esther is being written, it's meant to be evoking the story of Yosef. Okay, so between the thematic parallels and the linguistic parallels, I think we've made a pretty strong argument for this. And now the question is, why?
You want to take a seat, but you're free to sit down.
No,
we can sit around. No, okay.
Hmm?
We can sit around on the table if you want.
Whatever you want.
That's better. Why don't we sit around? Take a seat there.
No,
we'll sit around. Okay.
No.
Okay. No. Fine. Okay. I got outvoted.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I got outvoted.
No,
okay.
Okay. I'm okay either way. This way, I stay with
you.
You
asked the why.
Hmm.
They're both stories of redemption.
Okay. The both stories of
redemption. You're asking why are they thematic?
Right, meaning the authors of Megillat Esther had many different ways of writing the story.
Yeah.
Right? They very clearly chose to look at the story of Yosef as the model. And I'd like to explore a little bit more as to what's going on behind that.
Is there not a suggestion that Jewish history repeats itself?
That might be true, but that means that you have to recognize that it repeats itself. And when you write the story in a way that says that, then you're trying to say something.
Yeah, but both stories, I guess,
are
made in the same form.
Yes, which is?
That in a foreign land, you maintain, I believe, eventual divine redemption intervention will occur. I think like along those lines.
Okay. Interesting. Yes.
So I got to say something also in line. It's a lot in line with survive in not just in Galut, but survive in, you know, without without the obvious presence of Hashem. How does a Jew survive in an environment that is hostile to everything that, that he or she believes in?
Yeah.
But the Esther, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Josh is that the, you know, the mountains put over their heads, the acceptance of God is worse.
I'm not sure that connects back to the Yosef story. That connects back to Har Sinai, which is a somewhat different story. So yes.
I'd like to point out one difference between
yes.
Yosef didn't go there under his own free will. He was taken there. Mordechai, on the other hand, and the Jews who were there apparently went there on their own.
Excellent. Okay, and that. That is very interesting. It opens up a whole new area for exploration, but I don't want to get to that in a couple minutes.
Yosef didn't go on his own, but the rest of the Jewish people did. When they went to Egypt to escape the famine in Canaan. So that was a voluntary move away from Canaan to Galut.
So, yeah.
It always strikes me that the story of Yosef crops up exactly in Haggadah as well. Little creepy crawly ways, and the question always is, how did we get into this mess in the first place? So the question is, are we meant to be asking that question in this story as well as in the Yosef story?
Yeah, fair. You've touched upon a lot of really, really important pieces, and I'd like to sort of build on that and weave them together a little bit. I'd like to start with something cute. Yosef gets a foreign name. Right? We know all the people in Esther. Mordechai is not a Jewish name. Esther is not a Jewish name. We know what Esther's other name was. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah. We don't know what Mordechai's Hebrew name was, but you know, Mordechai was a very great Babylonian name based on the Babylonian god Marduk. Esther was based on the Babylonian goddess Ishtar. So they had those were their Persian / Babylonian names. Yosef has an Egyptian name. Yosef's Egyptian name is Tzofnat Paaneach. When you step back and let's see, what does Tzofnat Paaneach mean? Okay? It means the one who reveals that which is hidden. If I translate that into Hebrew, you get Megillat Esther. Megalah Etani Star, the one who reveals that which is hidden. So there's something going on over here, which I think is cute, but I think it speaks to something very, very profound. And that it requires us to look back at the Yosef story for a minute. I think in order to begin to suss this out a little bit more, you take a look at the Yosef story. The Yosef story, as you said, he goes down to Egypt against his will, and there are two elements that I think are really significant in the Yosef story for our purposes here. One is Yosef's life. When you look at him, he's sort of like riding a yo-yo. It's like a roller coaster. He starts off in his father's house, and he's the favorite one, right? And he's got an elevated position. It doesn't take long for him to abuse whatever position he has at home, and he ends up way down there in a pit. And then from the pit, he goes even further down because he ends up as a slave in Egypt. And as a slave in Egypt, he actually rises because he's got this great natural gift, right? That looks really amazing. Until he gets into trouble and goes back down again. And then when he's in jail, he again rises up. And then is again knocked down when Sarah Mashkim decides to forget him. And it's only at the end that Yosef actually rises and comes out and gets to a position from which he never comes down. if we want to understand Yosef's ups and downs, I think there's one key to understanding Yosef's ups and downs. And it has to do with Yosef's understanding of himself and of the role that God plays in his life. Yosef starts off, when we first meet him, he's 17 years old, and he's quite arrogant. Arrogant, self-centered, and a little bit unaware of anybody else around him. He tells his brothers the story of his dream. It gets them very, very angry, and he's clueless. So he tells them the next one. He doesn't get it, right? And he, guys, I had this dream. You want to hear my next dream? Right? He has no clue. And his arrogance brings him down. His brothers see him, and then let's see what's going to be with his dreams. And they take him, they throw him into the pit. He gets pulled out. And there's an amazing chapter in Sefer Bereshit. I think it's chapter Perek Lamed-Tet, where it's the story of Yosef in Potiphar's house. It's an extraordinary story, because, and if I just, I'm going to turn to there, I'm just going to read a couple of lines, and you're going to hear. You have a homage, you can look inside, but you'll just listen to the lines. Vayhi Hashem et Yosef, vayhi ish matzliach. That's number one. Vayar Adonav ki Hashem ito. The master saw that God was with him. Number two. Vayimtza Yosef chein be'inav. Number three. Vayhi me'az hifkido tov ve'beito v'al kol asher yishto. From the moment that his master put Yosef in charge, vayivarech Hashem et beit hamitzri beglal Yosef. Four. Vayhi berkat Hashem b'chol asher yeshlo v'payit v'asadeh. Five. In the opening five psukim of the story, we have five different times that we're told that Hashem is with Yosef and his master sees it. Truth is, it's not only his master sees it, but his master's wife sees it too. She sees Yosef as this wonder child, and she wants him. Right? She sees everything her master sees, but she has a different desire on this. Right? So she desires him. What's Yosef's response to her? He says, I can't, because I owe it to your husband. That means that Yosef sees himself as somebody with great talents. And who does he owe something to? To her husband. Where's God in all this picture? The master sees that God's involved. The master's wife sees that God's involved. Yosef doesn't get it. Into the pit. What happens when Yosef's in the pit? In jail? I skip now to the end of the parak. Vayhi Hashem et Yosef. Once again, God is with Yosef. Number six, this is six times in the parak already. Vayet elav chesed, vayitain chino be'enei sar beit hasohar. Okay, and then we go to the last pasuk of the parak. Ein sar beit hasohar ro'ed kol me'uma biyado v'asher Hashem ito. The head of the jail sees nothing about Yosef because God is with him. V'asher. Seven times in this parak, we have a repetition of the theme that God is with Yosef. And everybody around Yosef sees that God is with him, except for Yosef himself. That's the story of Yosef in Potiphar's house. He doesn't see what's going on. The story continues, and that's really an extraordinary story. The story continues when the Sar HaMashkim and the Sar HaOfim come into the jail. They both have dreams, and we're not going to go into the dreams now, it's a whole different story. But they both have these dreams, these these troubling dreams. And Yosef says a line to them. That's an interesting line, because I could interpret it in one of two ways. They're all distressed. And what does Yosef say? God has the answers. So tell me your dream. When Yosef tells them, God has the answers, he knows how to interpret dreams, tell me your dream. So what are two different ways of reading that line?
He's gone.
He says it in another place too. His ability to interpret is divine.
But he doesn't say that here.
But
later.
Yeah.
We'll get to later.
So that's what this line is saying.
Okay? So you want to say he's saying the same thing, right? God has interpretations, right? Right, so this could be read as Yosef saying, you know, God will help me to interpret your dreams. Right? Which is a very humble way of saying things. It could be read exactly the opposite. God knows, tell me. I have a direct line. He never says, God tells me. He says, Halel Elohim Pitronim Sapunali. So tell me. Well, why should we tell you if God has the answers? Implying that Yosef thinks that there's something godly even about himself. So that line can be interpreted in one of two ways. I'm open to both interpretations. Right? And here comes Yosef's amazing opportunity, because he interprets the dreams, and lo and behold, both dreams come true. But then something happens, because at that moment that Yosef says, you know, God, he invokes God's name, that's his ticket out of jail. But what does he say afterwards to Sar HaMashkim? He turns to him and says, Kim zechartani itcha kasher yitavlach, I want you to remember me when things get better for you. Vizkartani el paro, I want you to talk to Paro on my behalf. Vod seitani yabayit hazeh, I want you to take me out of this place. Why? Ki gunov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim. I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. I think he forgot something there. He portrays himself as an innocent victim. He forgot that he plays some kind of responsibility. That, right? I was kidnapped. I did nothing wrong. And then he adds, Vigampolo asiti mu'uma kisamu oti babo. Here also I did nothing wrong. We saw an entire parak in which everybody recognizes that Yosef has been brought to God except for Yosef himself. Chazal have negative things to say about Yosef in that story, and I think it's based on a very careful reading of the text itself. Chazal say Yosef was busy prettying himself. And I think there are ways to see that in the text itself. They clearly have critique of Yosef over here, and they see that Yosef sees himself as the secret of his success. And when Yosef says to Sar HaMashkim, Gampolo asiti ma'uma, here I did absolutely nothing wrong. I'm blameless. I am just the victim. It's at that point, I believe, that Hashem says you need a little bit more time to cook here in jail before you're ready to come out. Meaning, Yosef's ups and downs are really dependent on his ability not to be wise regarding other people, but to be wise regarding himself and regarding the hand that God plays in his life. When Yosef finally comes out of jail and he's brought in front of Paro, his language has changed, his tone has changed. And at that point, Paro says, I heard that you're a good dream interpreter. This is perfect for Yosef to say yes. That's what we would expect him to say. And what does he say? The first word out of his mouth is Bila Adai, not my hands. Elohim Ya'anesh.
saying an accused, and he's making his legal defense. I mean, he's not admitting his own responsibility. He's putting his best defense forward.
It could be.
The other accused would do before somebody who's got the power. But secondly, when he's out of power, I mean, Paro views himself as a god. It's like, for a slave to go in front of a god, you know, like figure, and say, well, I have all the answers. Rather, he's saying as equals, you know, I represent God, is my God has the answers. You are God, but there's not, you know, there's my God, and also he has had the protection. I mean, it's more an equality. He's trying to level the playing field.
Okay. That's an awesome.
Take more seriously, that power should take him more seriously by portraying him as a people, not as a, you know, as a low in powers of power.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to do. The way I'm seeing this is that when Yosef finally has learned humility, when he's standing in front of power, right, the first word he says out of his mouth is, I have no control. It's not me. Paro said, I heard you're a dream interpreter. He says, no, I'm not. Right? Earlier he said, yes, I am. And now he says, no, I'm not. Elokim ya'anech lo Paro. And it's from that point onwards that Yosef recognizes the role that God plays, that Yosef rises and never falls. And you hear the same thing from him repeatedly when he reveals himself to his brothers. What does he say? You did not sell me here. Listen to the change, right? When he said, I was stolen, I did nothing wrong, right? To, you did not sell me, it was all part of a divine plan. Meaning, Yosef, and the same thing happens after Yaakov dies, when the brothers are afraid that Yosef is going to take retribution. He once again turns to them and says, no, you are not the ones who are responsible, it was all part of a divine plan, I bear no grudges. For Yosef to be able to look and to finally get to the place that he understands that which we could have understood as perfectly reasonable in every other way as part of human interactions, Yosef has the opportunity to look back and to say, I finally got it. Right? Yosef, for most of his life, or for that chunk of his life between the age of 17 and 39, Yosef read the story of his life as an unfortunate set of circumstances happening to him. And at the age of 39, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, 37, he's standing in front of Paro, Yosef finally gets, wow, it's not me. It's God that has been doing this, and my success is only because Hashem has been on my side. And later on, he carries that with him, carries that perspective with him when he's talking to his brothers, when it doesn't make a difference. At that point, it's all the role that Hashem has played in his life. Yosef has taken a look at a completely secular story and has learned to read that story as a religious story. The authors of Megillat Esther were faced with a story. When you read it, they very clearly wrote a story that has God's name omitted. It would have been very easy to write the story with God's name in it. Balailahu vayaer Hashem et ruach Achashverosh. That night Hashem made Achashverosh sleepless. It would have been very easy to write that into the Megillah. Right? It would have been very easy for Megillah to have written at some point earlier, Vayar Hashem ki something, and as a result, Hashem arranged for Achashverosh to raise Haman into power. Sefer Melachim, all of Sefer Melachim reads that way. It's what they call dual causality. You read Sefer Melachim in every story, or not every, but many stories in Sefer Melachim are told in parallel. There's the political perspective, and then there is the divine perspective. For example, why did the kingdom split? So first, but we're told the kingdom split because it was punishment to Shlomo for his sins. That's what Sefer Melachim says. And then you read the story of Shlomo's son, and you realize the kingdom split because his son was a blithering idiot. He was a young, impetuous, power-hungry guy who didn't know how to control himself, and he listened to the wrong advisors, and, right? He just blew it. He was a political novice and didn't understand and didn't have the wisdom of his father, nothing. So you read Sefer Melachim, and we're told two stories in parallel. One is, how do you read this story as a political story, and this, or political military story? And the other is, how do you read this story as a religious story? Comes along Sefer Megillat Esther and leaves one of those layers out. It could very easily, with a couple of words, and it wouldn't have taken many words, the couple of words that could have inserted God's name into what happened at various points, and different interpretations would decide to put God's name into different places. Right? God got angry that Esther's marrying a non-Jew. That could be. Or God got angry, right? You can name any one of the things in there that you want to name. Chazal had no problem doing that. Chazal find lots of places to insert God into Megillat Esther. So why didn't the authors of Megillat Esther insert God into Megillat Esther?
It's interesting,
in Pasha Be'ish,
it's written in a similar style. In other words, Hashem is not explicitly mentioned here either, except in the mouth of Yosef.
Right.
It's not written in that style that you mentioned in Sefer Melachim. There's a two-level.
In Vayeshev it is, because Chol Asher Hu Oseh Hashem Masliach Biyado, God's role in that story is very, very explicit, right? But Yosef doesn't recognize that, and ultimately Yosef is the one who does come to recognize that. So on the surface level, I would like to suggest that the authors of Megillat Esther wrote this basically to mirror the Yosef story, but without the God in there, because they want to make sure that the Jews who are reading this understand that just like Yosef had to understand the role that God played in their history, in his life, so too the Jews reading this story have to do the same thing. And that's actually quite significant in a broader picture as well. Because when you take a look at Tanakh in general, okay, the story of Tanakh, and I'm going to do this in very brief, which is only going to focus on one little aspect. But the story of Tanakh tells the story of a God who's very, very overt in the world, who slowly pulls back. Right. Bereishit, God's right in front of us, he's doing all sorts of things. Shmot, God's right in front of us, doing all sorts of things. Once you get to Yahushua, Yahushua's an interesting blend. You know, God pulls down the walls of Jericho, but the people have to fight. They get to the next battle, the Battle of the Ai. So God teaches Yahushua military strategy and says, go do it. There are no miracles in the Battle of the Ai. As you go through Sefer Yehoshua, God retreats further and further into the background. You get into Sefer Shmuel. So Sefer Shmuel is a really interesting Sefer in that there are a few places that God spiced in there, but mostly, most of Sefer Shmuel is David deciding to bring God into the picture. David keeps turning to God saying, what should I do now? What should I do now? What should I do now? That's one of the features of David. You get to Sefer Melachim, and very little of Sefer Melachim has, except for the story, the stories of Eliyahu and Elisha, with their miracles, but very little of Sefer Melachim is about direct divine intervention, except through the eyes of the author. Meaning, we have political stories, we have political alliances in different places, we have the battles, and then the author keeps inserting God into the picture. To an extent, the story of Tanakh, when you take a look at the grand sweep of the narrative of Tanakh, basically, I'm going to jump out of the story of Tanakh, is the story of a parent raising a child. When that child is an infant, the child is completely dependent on the parent for everything. It can't feed itself, it can't change itself, it can't bathe itself. And as the child grows, So we want that child to learn independence. We teach that child to feed itself and to clothe itself until finally we get to children who are going to be grown-ups. And as grown-ups, we expect them to support themselves, to feed themselves, to take care of all those things. We would love it when they call us. We love it when they come back to us to talk to us. But they're not dependent on us anymore. And they should not be dependent on us. If they're still dependent on us when they're adults, we've done a bad job. Right? But that's the story of Tanakh. The story of Tanakh is where God raises people. And in the beginning, he's got to be in our face all the time so we know who he is. But then the goal, ultimately, is for him to step into the background, to leave the miracles as becoming more and more rare, so that by the time we get to the end of Tanakh, there's no more prophecy, there's no more nevuah, there's no more direct communication, there's no more overt intervention. And if God's going to play a role in our lives, it's because we choose to have him play a role in our lives, not because he has imposed himself on us. And that, I think, is the story of Tanakh as an ultimate goal. It's not God's retreating as punishment to us. It's exactly the opposite. It's God's retreating as an opportunity for us as human beings to begin to grow and to appreciate what we get from Hashem, and to learn what we have gotten from Hashem without being dependent in the same kind of way. Yes?
Isn't that thinking, well, again, it's like the concept of Rukhiyat, and that every, you know, that Rosh Hashanah, God tells you how much you're going to make for the year, and there's a sign that can, you know, we have no ability, I mean, in the extreme, like some, you know, let's say, you know, lady world says, you know, we don't have to work because, you know, God will provide. I mean, we can't do anything on our own that's going to increase our ability to make money or to increase our to health. We don't vaccinate our children because God will. No, I mean, we take that. I mean, there is a very strong hashkafa today, like, you know, that, you know, on certain sectors of society. And if you want to, you know, my thinking, they feel that's the ideal world, that Hashem is involved in each one of our lives that's being detailed. So, I mean, what you're saying, though, seems to be contrary to that.
It might very well be contrary to that, but not necessarily. Meaning these are people who have chosen to bring God into their lives. It's not that God...
I mean, the belief is that...
No, but that's the whole point.
Choose or not, it's not the point. I mean, God is...
No, but...
But
that is the point. The point is that God doesn't come to them. He doesn't show up on their doorstep on Erev Rosh Hashanah and say, by the way, you know that tomorrow's a big day. They have to decide that's something that they have taken upon themselves. I mean, all of that is stuff that comes from the bottom up. It's not coming from a position from the top down. Okay? And that's a choice that they have made in their lives. And I think every one of us makes choices in our lives in what way we bring God into our lives on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on an annual basis. But that's all coming from here. God's not imposing himself upon us. And, you know, students often ask me, why is there no revelation anymore? If God only would reveal himself, I believe. Well, truth is, it didn't work back then. It only worked for a short period of time, right? 40 days later, they're busy dancing around the Golden Calf, right? So it didn't work back then. It doesn't work. But also, that would defeat the whole purpose. The whole purpose is not for God to prove to us that he's here, but for us to choose that God is going to be part of our lives. I think, yeah.
But once you choose to bring God into your life, then you will see God in your life.
Right.
Then there is revelation.
But it's a self-chosen revelation.
It's a self-chosen choice to bring God into your
right.
life. The revelation is self-chosen, the revelation is the result.
Okay, that's fair. But that's a revelation in which literally we reveal. God's not revealing himself. We reveal God in nature. We reveal God in history. We reveal God in our lives. We discover God there.
I feel that we are allowing God in. And through allowing God in, God reveals himself.
Okay. But again, it's a process that begins with us.
Yes.
Right? And that's the story of Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther is a story that, you know, yesterday I spoke about Megillat Esther from a political perspective and how the politics of what was going on. And you could easily read the story of Megillat Esther as a political struggle between Mordechai and Haman on a personal level, on a political level, on a conceptual level, how Ahasuerus became an important piece of that because of his own neuroses, and how Esther plays on all of it. You could read the entire story through a human lens, a purely human lens, and see nothing of God's involvement in there. And in fact, that's the way the story of Megillat Esther is written. I think it's written intentionally that way. It's the story that's the end of Tanakh. It's the story in which if you want to read this as purely political events, that's your choice. You can do that. And if you want to read God into that story, that's also your choice. Now, interesting thing, Rav Soloveitchik once wrote, and you know, sometimes it takes very wise people to see things. Rav Soloveitchik once wrote that he was writing this in the 60s, in the late 50s or early 60s. He was writing about the UN, and he was complaining already about what the UN had become. We all know what the UN has become now. But he was complaining about what the UN had become. And he said, but you know what? God brought the UN into existence for one purpose, and only one purpose. It served its purpose in 1948. That was it. That was the most important thing. That was, he saw Yad Hashem in the fact that the UN was created post-World War II, and one of the first things that it did was it acknowledged and recognized the establishment of the State of Israel, and that was its purpose. Its purpose is finished, and it takes a certain kind of insight to look at events that are happening and understand those events as divine intervention. How many of us would have come to the same conclusion? Right? But Megillat Esther is the story that's basically it's essentially the end of Tanakh. It's the end of Revelation. It's certainly post-Revelation. And in a world that's post-Revelation where there are no Nevi'im, so how do we see God in our lives? And that's on one level, the story of Megillat Esther, where we have to be Megaleh the Nistar. We have to reveal that which has been hidden from us, and that is what God actually does in the world. And some people see that in their own lives personally on a day-by-day basis, the Hashgacha Pratit that you were talking about. Some people see it in the Hashgacha Kalalit of the Jewish people, of the history of the Jewish people and what has happened to us over the course of the last 75 years, and the extraordinary events that have taken place, and understanding that there is Yad Hashem in that. The authors of Megillat Esther are writing a manifesto for how to understand God's role in our life in Galut. And that's the parallel back to the story of Yosef. There are some interesting differences, by the way, to the story of Yosef, and maybe we'll get to those in a couple of minutes. What I'd like to do is I'd like to jump for a minute to one other story. And that's a story that is not as well known, and that's the story of Daniel. You know, many people know the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Right? He was thrown into a lion's den and he survived. Okay? But the story of Daniel is actually a much more interesting story than that. one of the reasons that Daniel is not as well known is it's written in Aramaic. It's very difficult to access. The second half of the book of Daniel is completely unintelligible. Try reading it in any language you can get a hold of it and see if you can tell me what it means, because I certainly don't. People have been trying for thousands of years. People see in Daniel, in the end of Daniel, secrets for when Mashiach is going to come at the end of the days. And they keep trying and they keep getting it wrong. And the Rambam, it's very funny, the Rambam writes that it's ridiculous and it's stupid to try to see from the end of Daniel, and then he does it himself about the end of days.
Does Daniel predate the beginning or post-date?
So that's a great question. It's a great question on a number of different levels. And Daniel's, we don't know. The best guess is, look, the beginning of Daniel relates to a period. We don't know when it was written. The beginning of Daniel talks to a period that is before Megillat Esther, explicitly before Megillat Esther. But the end of Daniel clearly refers to periods that are long, long, like hundreds, 100 years after, at least 100 years after the end of Megillat Esther. So the book spans a very, very long period of time. There had to have been at least more than one person named Daniel, because people didn't live for that extended period of time. And best guess is that the book was actually written and compiled and finished. It was some point after Megillat Esther. Here's the story of the book of at least in the beginning, one piece of the beginning of the book of Daniel. There's a king, there's a Babylonian king, who surrounds himself with good-looking young children. Sound familiar yet? Somebody who's surrounding himself with good-looking young women, right? He surrounds himself with good-looking young children, not women. He's not interested in sexual favors. He's interested in something else. This is a Babylonian king after Babel had conquered most of the world in the Middle East as we knew it then. And in order to build his empire, he brought in the best-looking and the smartest of the children from all the different nationalities that he conquered, and brought them into his palace, and hired special mentors to teach them. And these were going to be his closest advisors. He was going to bring them in as children. He was going to teach them to speak Aramaic. He was going to teach them all the Babylonian sciences, and they were going to grow up in the palace, and they were going to be the wisest, the smartest. He handpicked just the best and the brightest of all the people around him. He had them in his palace, and amongst those in his palace were four children who are from the Judean exiles. Like Mordechai HaYehudi, right? Doesn't mean Jew, means a Judean. Right? He was from this tribe of Judah, from the kingdom of Judah, who had been exiled. He had four children from the Judean exiles. Their names were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Four friends. Daniel was clearly the leader of that group. These guys, as they're brought into the king's palace, the king issues a command. I want them to be treated like royalty. I want them to eat at my table. They should eat the same kinds of things that I eat. Daniel says, oh, that's a problem. So he turns to the royal steward, and he said, or the guy in charge of them, and he said, can you do me a favor? Instead of giving us the royal food, can you just please give us the seeds, the grains that you would use to make the food? Give us the raw stuff. It's like going into a restaurant, can I have this? I'll have the salad, please. Right? Uncut. Right? Just give us the seeds. We'll eat the seeds. The steward says, I can't do that. Why not? Well, if I do that, you guys are going to look sickly. And the king is going to start inquiring as to why you look sickly. He's going to discover you're not eating the real food. He's going to chop off my head. They said, you know what? Test us out. See what happens. Daniel didn't want to eat non-kosher food. He says, okay, I'll give you a week. Gives them the food, they come back, they look healthier than everybody else. He said, okay, you passed the test, let's continue. And they go and they eat their seeds, they become very, they grow up in the palace, they grow very wise. One night the king has a dream, and the dream bothers him. One of the reasons the dream bothers him is because he doesn't even remember what the dream was. He knows he had a dream, the dream bothered him, and he wakes up in the morning and he can't. He calls in all of his advisors, and he asks them to interpret his dream. Does this sound familiar at all? Right? Somebody growing up in the king's palace, he's, right? The king has a dream, he can't interpret the dream, he calls in the advisors. None of the advisors can interpret the dream. The advisors, by the way, are called Chartumim. Sound familiar? The story of Yosef. Right? The story of Daniel has parallels back to the story of Yosef, but it also has parallels to the story of Esther. The problem is the king doesn't even remember his dream, so he calls in his advisors and says, I'm going to start killing you. They say, king, if you tell us the dream, we can interpret it. But if you don't know the dream, how can we interpret it? He says, I don't care. It's your job. You're the wizards. You figure it out. They say, we can't. He says, okay, I'm going to start killing you one by one. So he starts killing them one by one. Daniel hears cries that are going on. He hears what happened. He goes over to the guy in charge and says, tell the king to stop killing them. I'll take care of him. He davens, comes to the king and says, I know your dream and I know the interpretation. And he tells him the dream and he tells him the interpretation. King loves the dream. He says, yes, that's the dream. He loves the interpretation. And Daniel is put second in command of the kingdom. Sound familiar yet? Right? We have the story of Yosef and the story of Esther converging now into the story of Daniel. Okay. What happens? He's second in command, everything's wonderful, but now there's jealousy. Because all the other people who had been advisors and had been in power all of a sudden have been surpassed by this guy over here, and they try taking him down. So here's what happened. They went to the king and they came up with a plot. Okay? Sounds familiar, right? The themes keep repeating themselves, and now we have themes from two different stories that are weaving themselves back into the story of Daniel. They come with a plot. The king's dream was about this great big statue. It was a statue that was gold at the top and then became silver and then became bronze, and at the bottom was plaster. And Daniel's interpretation was, you have an empire over here, you're the gold, you're the crown. Not you. The next generation is going to be the silver, the next generation is going to be the copper, eventually plaster is going to crumble. Your empire is going to crumble after four generations, and the Babylonian Empire is going to go. The king's understood, and then he went and built, he went and built a model of what Daniel had described to him. His advisors come to him and say, King, I think you should make a royal decree that anybody who prays, anybody who bows down, has to bow down only to your model over here. Only to your big pesel. And nobody's allowed to pray. In fact, everybody who passes here must pray to the pesel. And those who pray not to your pesel have to be killed. So anybody who doesn't pray to your pesel has to be killed, and anybody who prays to something other than your pesel has to be killed. And that's how Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah get into trouble, because they don't pray to the pesel. And that's how Daniel gets in trouble, because Daniel is caught in his room. Somebody saw him through the window, davening, facing Yerushalayim. King is stuck. What do I do now? Advisors tell him, look, it's a royal decree. You can't undo a royal decree. Sound familiar? Ahasuerus can't undo a royal decree. The decree was that person who has to get thrown into the lion's den. Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den, comes out alive, the king says, your God is the real God, etc. Okay, and that's in short, the story of Daniel. The parallels between them, you've seen them moving in, and there are lots and lots and lots of other parallels. We have the young people who are brought in, they have long periods of preparation. We have the exiles from Judea. We have Daniel gets a foreign name. He's called Belshazzar. Mm-hmm. Just like all our other heroes. He's commanded to be Korea Unishtachaveh. Right? Just like in the story of Purim. And by the way, when Chazal talk about Haman wearing an idol around his neck, right, they're borrowing that from the story of Daniel. They're weaving the two stories together. There's a story about refusing to bow down to the idol. So refusing to bow down to the idol of Daniel translates into refusing to bow down to Haman because the idol of, right? It's the same language, the same kind of theme. Chazal wove these things together. This is a great example of where Chazal read Tanakh very, very deeply. Their comments are comments that reflect a very deep reading, but they wrote them in ways, in Midrashic kinds of ways, that are so easily misunderstood when you don't read Tanakh first. So every third grader in yeshiva knows that Mordechai refused to bow down because Haman was wearing an idol around his neck. But what they don't know is that what Chazal are doing is they're not commenting on Haman, they're really commenting on the parallel between the two stories. Okay. We have, the same thing is true, by the way, in the story of Daniel. There's a party in which the king is drinking from the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash. What do Chazal do? They take that and they write that right into the beginning of the story of Megillat Esther. V'chelim mikelim shonim. And right away the Midrash says, oh, those kelim, that came in the Beit HaMikdash. Chazal didn't make that up. They got it from the parallels between the two stories. They wove them together. They said, this story teaches me about this one and this one about this one. And there are languages, the Ahashtar Panim and Pachot, and that language you find in both stories is clear that the two stories are woven together. So there are multiple levels of parallel between those two stories. And as is clear with the whole business of the dreams, there are lots of parallels back to the story of Esther. What's the story of Daniel? The story of Daniel may very well be a critique. A critique of Megillat Esther. Right? And let me look at this on the simplest level. Okay? Daniel is in the king's palace. And he refuses to eat the king's food. He takes a stand. I'm only going to eat kosher. He takes a principled stand in his identity. He never hides who he is. And takes a principled stand. Esther didn't do that. Esther married a non-Jew. And at the end of the story, she's still married to a non-Jew. Chazal was very, very bothered by that. They had their own ways of expressing that distress. But they were very, very bothered by that. How could Mordechai put her into that position? How could Esther agree? The story of Daniel may very well be a way of saying, wait a minute, you read that story, and you wrote that story as a story of how Jews should survive in Galut. Excuse me, but I think there's a much different way of doing it. Surviving in Galut does not mean secretly clawing your way into the halls of power. Surviving in Galut does not mean hiding your Jewish identity. Surviving in Galut, and not just surviving, but thriving in Galut, can be by maintaining who you are, being proud of who you are, and being prepared to suffer the consequences of who you are. And that's on the very simplest level. But I think there's another layer that's much more subtle, that suggests that there's a much deeper critique over here of the story of Esther. Because the story of Esther is problematic on multiple ways. And I'm going to go back for a minute to the story of Yosef. One of the things that's one of the subtexts of the story of Yosef, which again would take a very long time to really develop, but really comes out in a conversation that Yosef has with his father Yaakov. When in the beginning of Parashat Vayechi, Yaakov calls Yosef in and talks to him. And when he talks to him, he starts talking about Eretz Kanaan. Right? El Shaddai Nira Eli Beluz, the Eretz Kanaan. God appeared to me in Eretz Kanaan. Vayavarech oti, and it was there in Eretz Kanaan that he blessed me. And he told me, Hinani mafrecha v'hir biticha, etc. Right? I'm going to give you a lot of kids. So now, you have two kids here. They were born here in Egypt, but I want to take them as mine. Shnei banecha hanuladim lecha be'eretz Mitzrayim ad bo'i lecha Mitzrayim. The two kids that were born in Mitzrayim before I came here, lihein, I want to take them as mine. God promised me more children. I didn't have more children after that. So I want to take these as my children. Kiruvein Mishim on Yihuli, they'll be my children. And then he continues talking about Eretz Kanaan. What's Yaakov concerned about? Here he is. He's been living in the land of Canaan for 17 years. In the land of Mitzrayim for 17 years. He sees Yosef. Yosef is his favorite child who he no longer recognizes. He's an Egyptian prince. He's second in command. His kids, Yosef's kids, they were born in Egypt. They were raised in Egypt. Look at the name of the first one. Nashani Elokim et kol amali ve'et kol beit avi. Baruch Hashem, I forgot my parents' house. That's Yosef. Yosef is the guy who suffered a lot in Egypt.
In Canaan.
He suffered in Canaan. He suffered at the beginning in Egypt. And made it. He made it big time. And he says, this is the land of the future of our clan. This is the future. Dad, we're not going back to Europe. This is the future. This is the golden of Medina. That's what Yosef tells his father. And Yaakov is nervous about that. Because Yaakov remembers that there is a promise. There's a promise of Eretz Kanaan. There's a promise that Hashem gave him. There's a promise that was given to his grandfather. There's a unique relationship that he has with Hashem. So Yaakov wants to take Ephraim and Menashe. He wants to skip over. He's given up on Yosef. But he wants to take Ephraim and Menashe as his because he wants them to become children of Canaan. Yaakov finishes speaking and then turns to Yosef and says, "Mi ela, so who are these kids?" What kind of question is that? He knows who they are. He's talking to them. He's talking in front of their face. What does that mean, mi ela? Well, Yaakov, they just took them. What do you say? And what's Yosef's response? Yosef's response is, Banayim, they're mine. Asher natan li Elokim, God gave them to me. Bazeh, here. These are my children. They're Egyptians. They belong here. And we have a profound machloka here between Yaakov and Yosef as to what the future of Am Yisrael is going. That machloket, once you understand that, you read the whole story, and all of a sudden there are all sorts of things that are understandable, and you'll begin to notice lots and lots of other things. What happens? Crazy. This part's really crazy. Yaakov dies. Yosef gives him a beautiful Egyptian funeral. He's embalmed 70 days. Right? There's a great big avelut here in Mitzrayim. There's Egyptian mourning. And when they take him, because he insisted, I want you to take me to Canaan to bury me there. And that's part of this whole story. When they take him, the people locally say, wow, that's a great big Egyptian funeral. Avel kaved zel Mitzrayim. This is a great big mourning day for Egypt. Then there's a private ceremony where Yosef and his brothers go. Or actually, it's the brothers. Yosef's not even mentioned. Where the brothers go, and the brothers take Yaakov to be buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah the way he asked. There's a private Jewish burial, which is separate from the Egyptian mourning. Yosef is an Egyptian viceroy. He's giving his father an Egyptian funeral. The brothers have been given a command by Yaakov. I want you guys to make sure that I get a different kind of funeral. I'm buried in Ma'arat HaMachpelah. How does the story end? The story ends with Yosef finally understanding what Yaakov meant. The very, very end, the last line of Sefer Bereishit, Yosef turns to his brothers and says, God's going to take you out of here. I see it now. I get it. It's not until Yosef is an old man that he gets it. But he turns to his brothers and says, God's going to take you out of here. Please take my bones and take them with you. I know, there's no way you're going to bury me in Canaan, but take my bones at the end when finally the promises come true. Yosef finally gets it. He understands that Mitzrayim is not the end goal. And indeed, later on, we find that the beginning of Parashat Beshalach, when they leave, Moshe takes Yosef's bones. He's looking around to find them. They take, and ultimately, the beginning of Sefer Yoshua, or the end of Sefer Yoshua, and Yosef's bones are buried in Shechem. Right? Yosef got it. It took a long time for him to get it, but he finally got it. What about Megillat Esther? That Megillat Esther end. Oh, yeah. Achashverosh is stronger than ever. Mordechai is second in command. And the Jews are firmly entrenched in the Persian Empire more than they have ever been. That's their future. What does Sefer Daniel say? What got Daniel into trouble? He's davening. And where's he facing? Yushalayim. Daniel understands that the center of Jewish life is not there in Babel. The center of Jewish life is Yushalayim. There's a little, a not very well understood piece of Sefer Yirmiyahu. I have to thank Rabbi Lau for pointing this out in his book, because he opened my eyes to this. The Galut from Babel took place in a number of stages. Okay? There was a very early preliminary stage, and then there was a major exile of the cultural elites, all the royals and the cultural elites. That was in the time of Jehoiakim, the king. And then there was another exile that took place about 12 years later. A little bit longer than that. Of the rest of the people. Okay, and that was the massive exile. That first group, in the time of Jehoiachin, they were taken out, they weren't killed. But Nebuchadnezzar said, I don't trust you guys. I don't trust the leadership here. So I'm bringing you with me. He takes them into exile. And they go and they set up a community in Babel. It becomes a thriving community. These are all the rich businessmen and lawyers and politicians and the king and the entire royal family and some Kohanim and some others, right? And they all go to Babel and they build a beautiful community there. So much so that the king, Jehoiachin, still calls himself king. I'm the king in exile. And now there's a machloket between the two communities, which one is the real one, right? Who is the real royal family? Are they the royals that were exiled to Babel, who managed to take all their wealth with them and everything they had, they packed them up on, you know, big wagons, or the poor Jews that were left behind to languish under Tzidkiyahu and Babylonian ownership, right? And there's tension between the two of them. And there are indications in Sefer Yirmiyahu that there was communication between them. In fact, at one point, there was a group of exiles who are writing letters to the people in charge in Yerushalayim saying, why are you letting Yirmiyahu running around saying all those terrible things? Shut up! They're trying to control what's happening in the Beit HaMikdash by remote control from Babel. So you've got this whole community there, and they are very, very well established. They see themselves as not just the government in exile, but maybe even the new home of the Jewish people. Okay, we'll set up another Jewish commonwealth just here in Babel. This is our new home. One of the people who went out in that exile was Mordechai's ancestor. How do I know this? It's right there in Megillat Esther. Asher havlam Yerushalayim, im hagula asher havlata, im yichonya melech Yehuda. Right? They went out the galut of Yechonya. Mordechai was part of that royal elite. He was part of that cultural elite. Those people set themselves up in Babel, and they saw their future, the future of the Jewish people there in Babel. There's a piece that I pointed out yesterday at the end of the Megillah, which suggests that there's a lot of tension between Mordechai and the people about who owns Purim. Right? Purim started out as a spontaneous eruption, grassroots by the people, and a celebration, and Mordechai tries legislating it as a Persian legislation. Persian law. He sends out letters, just like he sent out all the other letters of Persian law, right, to all the exiles. And it's interesting that there are a couple of lines in here that raise for us some interesting questions. Yoni Grossman pointed out one of them to me, in his book. He didn't point that to me personally, but in his book, Mordechai sends out these letters to the Jews who are krovim urechokim. But krovim and rechokim, they're close and far to where? To Shushan. Where does Mordechai see the seat of the Jewish people? Shushan. Right? We know what Shushan is. Shushan is a cosmopolitan city that was the center of a portion of the Persian Empire. It may not have been the center of the entire Persian Empire, but certainly a center of a portion of the German Empire. And everything is measured relative to Shushan. There's Mordechai in Shushan, in the capital of the Jewish people, completely enmeshed and embedded into the Persian culture. He sits and walks through the halls of the palace. He eventually becomes second in command to the king. And Jews are measured by how close or how far they are from Shushan. That's the center. Here's a line that should bother everybody here. And I don't know why it hasn't bothered anybody. I haven't seen anybody who comments on this. King issues his decree. Va'ir Shushan Navocha. Why is the city of Shushan depressed over the murder of Jews? It's like the city of Toronto. It doesn't say the Jews of Shushan. Va'ir Shushan Navocha. Later on, there's another decree. Mordechai's decree. Va'ir Shushan Sa'ola V'Samecha. The city of Toronto, Washington, D.C., was rejoicing. Why is Washington D.C. rejoicing? Clearly, Mordechai saw that Shushan, right? I think there's more to it than just this, but Shushan is the center. It is where this is all about. Esther also saw Shushan as being really important. She said Shushan should have an extra day. Shushan, later on they said Shushan should have a special day of rejoicing, different from everybody else. Well, why can't we all just rejoice together? No, because we have to highlight Shushan as being special. Chazal were very uncomfortable with that. The Megillah says that all the cities that were open cities celebrated on the 14th, and all the cities that were walled cities celebrated on the 15th. And Chazal said, wait a minute, that can't be. What do you mean by walled cities? You want cities to be modeled after Shushan? Are you trying to tell me that this holiday that you want to institute over here is going to have Shushan as its primary model? No. They changed it. They said walled cities from when? From the time of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. It's the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. And basically, we only know of two cities, you know, that were still around, that were there, that were walled cities from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun. You're talking about Yerushalayim and Hebron. What are Chazal saying? Hello? You want a celebration for all of Am Yisrael? And you want them to be celebrating Shushan? No. Celebrate Yerushalayim. They have to be walled cities from the time of Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim has to be your frame of reference. That has to be your center. That has to be your core. There are a number of other things. When you look at Torah Shba'al Peh, there are a number of things that indicate just how uncomfortable Chazal were with the story of Megillat Esther and the story of Purim and the holiday of Purim, aside from the Gemara that talks about the fact that Esther had to argue with Chazal about whether to include the Megillah. And Esther had to argue with Chazal as to whether to include the holiday of Purim. Here's a little thing.
Do you think they're arguing because of this lack of Israel centeredness?
I think it plays a very major role. And what?
Celebrating a final Semitic culture, but not one.
Yeah. You take a look at Masechet Megillah, the Mishnayot of Masechet, not the Gemara. The Gemara reflects other ambivalences, but the Mishnayot. There are four chapters in Masechet Megillah. Of those four chapters, one deals with Purim. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi had to create, he had no choice but to create a Masechet revolving around Purim. And what he decided to do was he threw everything else in the world into the Masechet. There's one out of four chapters that deals with Purim. Here's how the opening one starts. And I'm going to just read this in slightly different words. Let's see if we can divorce the celebration of Purim from the reading of Megillat Esther.
That's why it has this
theological. Right? So, how do you do that? Well, you can read Megillah 3 days early. You don't have to read it on Purim. You can read it 2 days earlier. All right, you know, if you happen to be going to market, you can read it a day or, right? The first thing they do is let's divorce Megillat Esther from the holiday of Purim. Can you imagine them saying, okay, you know, Parashat Zachar, do it
like Lila Seder.
Lila Seder, right. Or, you can give it a better example. Can you imagine them saying, okay, so you can eat the Karban Pesach, you have to eat the Karban Pesach on the night of the 15th, but you can do the Haggadah 3 days beforehand.
Me Rosh Chodesh.
Right?
Me Rosh Chodesh.
Right? Right? Exactly the opposite.
Right.
It's unbelievable. Let's take a look at a couple of other things that Chazal did, that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did in the Masechet. The meal can be split.
Meal's not even mentioned in the Mishnayos at all. We're talking
right,
about that on Friday.
Right.
The Suda does not come up at all.
Right. So the meal, which is the Suda, which is one of the mitzvot,
drinking,
right, does not appear at all in the Mishnayot. And there are some other strange things that come up as well. Oh, here's a suggestion. Maybe you want to read the Megillah backwards.
Yeah, I carry the Megillah for you.
Now, eventually they said you can't. But you never hear them say read the Haggadah backwards.
And you don't have to read the whole Megillah.
Right?
You don't have to read the whole Megillah.
Whole notion of read it out of order. Oh, you know what? How about if you read it and you fall asleep in the middle? And then you continue and you fall asleep again.
It's hard with all those words.
Right? Meaning, what are Chazal doing over here? That there's something, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi in the Mishnah, right? It's so clear. There's something there that's bothering him. And I suspect that there are probably a lot of things that are bothering them, but one of the things that are bothering them is the fact that the story of Megillat Esther celebrates Jewish assimilation in a foreign culture as an ideal of Jewish survival.
But then the real question is why? In other words, become permitted? Why didn't they? Why did Chazal agree with Esther? Why didn't they say, Esther, go jump in the lake? We're not making Purim holiday. It's not in Tanakh. I mean, it is in Tanakh. It is a holiday.
Right. And I think that both the story of Yosef, basically, if Megillat Esther is built on the story of Yosef, it misses the punchline. Because the punchline of the story of Yosef is, this is not the future. This is just a stepping stone to go back to Eretz Canaan. And the story of Daniel says, don't even stick your foot into that mire. You go in there, stand straight, say who you are, stand up with your values, and let the chips fall where they are. There are three different versions over here of what it means to live and to thrive. I'm not even talking about survive, but to thrive as a Jew in Galut. The story of Megillat Esther is one version. Writing it in the context of those of the story of Yosef picks up on the theme of discovering God, but also misses a core theme of the center of Jewish life.
But then why is Purim celebrated?
And then the story of Daniel is the complete opposite on both ends, both on the religious end and on the national Yerushalayim end. So now you raise the question, so why do we celebrate it? Right? Chazal were ambivalent.
But they wanted to celebrate. That's why you have this whole message of hiddenness in Esther. They wanted to take away this political assimilation and make it more theological. Maybe that's why
speaking to a different generation, if you know what I mean. I think that Purim is speaking, Daniel said that Daniel is speaking back to a generation where people still have clear memories of the source of who we are. But it seems to me that the Purim story is talking about a population which is already hugely assimilated. Esther herself is hugely assimilated. Mordechai maybe not, but Esther is definitely an assimilated Jew. And making it speaking to that kind of generation, Purim has tremendous value, because how do you survive as a Jew in an environment like that where you are already hugely assimilated?
For the Jew who won't go back to Israel. Main point about the Jew, I know some of them.
They know some of
them? Who won't go back to Israel. Look in the mirror.
The other thing, this obviously the story of Purim didn't happen the time of the redaction of the Minhag of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, or redaction of the Gemara. I mean, it happened hundreds of years, it happened at the end of the first Purim. So here you have Chazal sitting, and you have to give an I think it's tough to. You're saying it's a hard lesson, but we are at the cusp of, maybe they had some sort of real punishment in 2,000 or more years ago. And we need a story. How do you survive it in a thing where God is not absolute, that God is hidden, that we have absorbed the culture. Our names are named after, you know, it's like having boys who are cited in Christian or Christina or something like that. And yet, we have to carry on. No, and Mordecai says to Esther, he says, look, he says, we're going to survive. It's a question, what are you going to do? Are you going to be part of this ongoing shalshalat, or are you going to remove yourself and assimilate? That's almost the key sentence in the Gemara. It says, you know, we're going to survive like God gave us, you know, the brief that, you know, we're not going to be wiped out. But the question is it you as part of the Jewish community, are you going to be part of it or not? And I think that's the lesson that Chazal decided, you know, maybe it's not the perfect, you know, future, but the future is not going to be perfect.
So I hear two different, completely different approaches emerging over here. One says there's a theological message that they're trying to convey, and that's why they agree. And the other says it's a pragmatic. It's not theological, it's all pragmatic. Look, the bottom line is there are going to be Jews who remain in Galut. There are going to be Jews who are going to live that kind of life, and we need to give them a model too. I think there's a third possibility as well, and I don't think these are necessarily mutually exclusive. It could be that there are lots of things going on, and I suspect that you could both be true, because if we go back to the Gemara, there's this debate between Esther and the Chachamim. There are two debates. One debate is about the Halakha, and there's a second debate about the book. The book is included in Tanakh. For the book to be included in Tanakh is a theological statement. For the holiday to be celebrated is a very pragmatic kind of statement, which could be, by the way, and this we know from lots of other places as well, that the celebrations of Purim were not legislated from the top down. Right? That's that whole tension at the end of the Megillah. The celebrations of Purim started as a spontaneous grassroots celebration started by the people. They did it. They decided to do it again. They did it enough time that it became part of what they were doing. Mordechai tried transforming it and was, in one way, he was able to transform it by adding the matanot le'evyonim. He was not able to transform it into a Persian holiday. Ultimately, when Mordechai reclaims his identity as Mordechai HaYehudi, and Esther is Esther Bat Avichayim, and they send out that letter at the end, and they write a letter as brothers and sisters of the rest of the Jewish people, well, we know that you've started this, so let's continue this. Let's decide to do this all together, right? It's no longer a royal Persian decree. It is, let's together agree to continue this practice. And now you have a practice that has been entrenched. Chazal may not have been happy about the way it came about, but they can't not accept it anymore. There is a practice in terms of the holiday itself. There is definitely a pragmatic element in there. And by the way, the notion of minhag, minhag is being a very important force in halacha. And here you see a great example. The Jewish people have accepted this upon themselves. And what Chazal then decided to do was they accepted it, okay, grudgingly, but if we're going to accept it, let's try to shape it a little bit. Let's try to give it a book that is going to tell a theological message that's going to be a little bit difficult to suss out. We're going to help you do that. But what they did was they took what was there and then tried transforming that something that could be not just something popular emerging from the ground up, it's something that they could help to shape into something meaningful for the future. I'll take your comment in just 1 minute. I just wanted to wrap up for 1 second. So we have three models. There's the model of Yosef. He's the one who was thrown into exile against his will, but then embraced it, and ultimately learned to rediscover his roots. I think we all know people like that. There's the model of Daniel. The model of Daniel who says, I may have been thrown here against my will, but I'm proud of who I am and I'm never going to hide that. You can change my name, but that's not going to change who I am. I'm going to be loyal to my religion, I'm going to be loyal to my people, I'm going to be loyal to my Yerushalayim no matter what. And then there's the model of Esther. The model of Esther was the one that Daniel was really, really uncomfortable with. And yet, the model that Chazal ultimately decided to agree to, I don't know if they would have created this, but they were the ones who ultimately agreed to it once it came from the people and tried shaping that in a way that could be meaningful to Jews, beyond.
Okay. And then they say that Purim is the one holiday
yes.
that will survive. Purim then becomes the holiday
yes,
of
exactly.
the Jewish people.
Right. There's a lot right. more to say about this. We've just touched, and by the way, once you understand this, I think you start learning Gemara, and you begin to see lots of things that Chazal are saying that didn't make sense beforehand, and all of a sudden they start making sense. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, when Yosef, the brothers come to Benjamin, that he gives Benjamin the five things of extra clothing, and some of the rabbis said it's a remiss to Mordechai, when Mordechai will eventually. Did Yosef see something in the exile of Mordechai being the leader, also who's from Ishtar Mini, also from Benjamin, this idea of Joseph and Benjamin and the passing in the future of the torch of leadership and the way it would eventually play out in an exile sense?
I think Chazal certainly want to read that into it. Absolutely.
Yeah. To support what you're saying, at the end of the Megillah, it says that Mordechai was protected of Rohabachim, not all.
Yes.
And the question is, why is it that we concentrate more on Talmud Chavni and not so much on Rohabachim?
That's
a whole other story.
That's another. He has a plane to catch.
Anyway, I'm going to wish you a Chag Sameach. Thank you for joining me in this learning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.